And then he figured, oh, I hit India.
Yeah.
And then when he seen the people that look similar to Indians, say, oh, it must be India.
And why go from Columbus to Indigenous Peoples Day? Because people have educated a certain number of people, not those people you ran into, obviously, but that Columbus represented, you know, this feudal European country that engaged in the slave trade, that that was coming here to get slaves and oil, and not oil, sorry, that's
gold.
Now gold, and land, and et cetera. And it was all about conquering and exploiting.
And converting and, the natives.
And that we're using religion to help that. And as a prop for that.
And you want to see why Latin America is going through the same, because it's the colonized mind. We're still suffering it today.
Yeah, and...
So, thank you, Columbus.
Yeah, so there's basically, there was a movement, I'm not sure where it started exactly. It might have been Seattle, it might have been Richmond, California, but in Seattle where a member of Socialist Alternative, Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, last name Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T, was elected in late 2012 or 2013, I believe. Might be a little off on the timing there. Shama was elected to her first term. She's just been recently reelected to her second term as an open socialist, as a member of Socialist Alternative. And one of the issues that she helped provide a leadership on, and Socialist Alternative helped lead along with indigenous groups in Seattle itself, was to change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, at least in terms of the name. And there was a lot of resistance, but it did pass. And now there's other places that have done it, including Cambridge, Massachusetts, right near where we're broadcasting from. So, yeah, tomorrow is the holiday for many people. Not enough people, but for some people. I get it off. Do you get it off by any chance?
No.
Tomorrow, yeah. So, in America here, I'm just laughing because America is not really the right word anyway. Here in the United States, people are there's these holidays where like not everybody gets the holiday off. You know, they still say it's a holiday, and I get the feeling Columbus Day is one of those days, or Indigenous Peoples Day, excuse me, is one of those days that a lot of people don't actually get it off. That's kind of my gut feeling.
And I want to say at one point
I do get
that
it off,
changed that you got, if you did work, you got time and a half.
Yes, exactly. Oh, so much has changed.
But that
are you
just
kidding?
Boop.
Hey, get,
nobody
you know,
knows.
Guess
about
what they're
that.
Going after now? I just found out about this last week.
Martin Luther King.
The
said.
Rotten, and I'm not going to say it because I'm on the air. The Democrats here in Massachusetts, along with the token Republican Baker, I'm sure the Republicans, the token Republicans, support this too. Obviously. They're going after now that little Massachusetts law, and I think it exists in some other states, of you get paid, if you're in retail, you get paid time and a half on Sundays. They're going after that, man.
Oh.
They're going after that. They want to crush it. And the liberals are all into crushing it, too, but in a nicer way. The liberals, like in the Boston Globe, they want to say, yeah, this is a outmoded
So if
law.
I went back to retail like Whole Foods, I'd
you
be
don't
at,
get time and a half on Sunday. It's straight time.
Straight time.
So... the liberals of the Boston Globe are like, well, it should just be phased out. Let's just have it grandfathered so the people that get it now get it, but the people that come in don't get it. And that is the worst two-tier wage crap. That's what, killing the labor movement, killing the workers' movement, because obviously the bosses will fire or do whatever they can to get rid of the people that are making that.
Like
they're not,
me.
They're not going to put them on the schedule.
Yep.
They're not going to. They're going to. And then it's going to be gone soon. It's like, you know, phasing out rent control in New York. And look at the gentrification. And, you know, watch out. Watch out. This is relevant to our discussion on the elections. Watch out for the obvious enemy. And then the one that's not so obvious but will stab you in the back, if that's the way you perceive the world. Now, for socialists, revolutionary socialists, it's obvious the Democrats and Republicans, leaderships, their elites, are representing capitalism. It's just so obvious we shouldn't even have to talk about it, but we do because a lot of people don't get it. They're taught not to get it, right? But if you even have that perception of the nicer capitalist versus the harsher capitalist, the liberal Boston Globe, and you think liberal is good versus the conservative bad, for us liberals and conservatives, conservative positions are bad. Not the individuals that hold them. That's a progress. That's a transition, good or bad. But the point is that listen to that example, one of a billion. Or take privatization. Right now, they're privatizing. This is a state dominated by the Democrats. The legislature is dominated by the Democrats. every non-elected board is dominated by the Democrats. The Republicans come in. Baker gets elected as a Republican. He can put some forward some nominations, some of which are Republicans here or there. But he's just sprinkling a field dominated by the Democrats, right? So what are they doing now? They're privatizing the T. Are the Democrats out leading protests against privatizing the T? No, they are not. You know, seven members of the Carmen's Union, unfortunate name choice, but American Transit Workers Union, local here in Boston, they just got arrested for protesting. I don't know if you saw this, Diego. They got arrested for protesting privatization of part of the MBTA work, which is which in this case was collecting money. Where they count the money that's collected and all that. And the Globe writes this thing, they quote this guy without any counter quote or anything. It's only logical that money handling operations are not handled by people in the union. Why is that logical? That's not logical at all. The opposite is logical. The opposite is logical. You want union workers in there. You want well-paid workers handling money. So they've outsourced that now to Brinks, a multinational corporation, you know, that transfers capitalist money around.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be a public service, not a business, right? But the Democrats aren't doing anything to stop it. Nothing. They're going along with it. Now they're going to go after the warehouse workers in the MBTA. They're going to go after bus drivers and bus routes. And again, the liberal way to slip this in is to say, oh, anyone that lost their job in the money room, we're going to see if they can get a job maybe driving a bus. But the same, then in the next breath, they talk about privatizing the buses. Where's that going to be? Or maybe they'll keep the workers that are there, but then the next one will be from the privatized thing. Either way, you're getting stabbed in the back bad by the Democrats, who that union probably, unfortunately, supports. I don't know that for a fact, but I would bet you good money that, like most unions right now, they're pouring our dues money, those of us that are in unions, into the Democratic Party, which is a corporate, pro-capitalist political party we have no business being in, no business voting for, and no business giving our money to. That's crap. And we're suffering horribly for it. You know, the thing about lesser evilism, meaning the Democrats are the lesser evil to the Republicans, is that I've been around long enough now to see it for generations lead to a decline, a steep decline in living standards, a steep decline in workers' rights. We've got 6% union density in the private sector, 30-something percent in the public sector, but under severe attack, like the MBTA workers. So who knows what the real percentage is going to be when the smoke clears and the next time they come out with those figures. Very, very hard to organize a union. Democrat Obama promises to come in 2008 with Employee Free Choice Act, which would have made it supposedly easier to organize unions. Didn't even propose it as a law, just ignored it as it was a big campaign promise. The AFL-CIO went around saying that's why we're supporting him, you know. And then he just turns his back on it, doesn't even try to get it passed. And I'm not talking about Obama individually, I'm talking about Obama plus his regime. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Killary now. I got an email from...
Killary,
Killary Clinton. I got an email from Hoffa, the guy that used to be in the United Mine Workers Union, which is a shattered union, Trumka. Trumka saying, vote for Hillary, you know. Why? I don't even remember any reasons given, actually, you know. I'm sure there were some that were lies, but I just don't even remember those. It's like vote for Hillary. You know, I mean, it's just absurd. Anyway, before we get more into the elections again, I know I keep saying that. We gotta talk about for a second about this movie coming up called The 13th. And I don't know how many people have heard about this. I hadn't heard much about it, but The 13th is a movie about the 13th Amendment, which is the amendment that outlawed slavery, except in the case of people that supposedly commit crimes or have committed crimes, and then you're allowed to apparently use slave labor, like labor in prisons and so on. So this is a documentary by Ava DuVernay, who I don't know much about, sorry. Didn't have time to do the research. This film is opening, I think it was produced by Netflix. It says the film debuts Friday on Netflix and at the Lamley Film Center in Santa Monica. This was written October 6th, so I think it's opening around. And I'm reading from somebody named Carrie Rickey, wrote something for Truth Dig about this. And it quote, the film chronicles how incarceration is the latest in the ongoing subjugation of blacks since slavery was abolished more than 150 years ago. In her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, Michelle Alexander says that throughout American history, African Americans have been subjected by differing systems of racial and social control that appear to die, but are reborn in new forms tailored to the needs and constraints of the time. So the police militarization, police racism, coupled with mass incarceration, you have a new form of slavery now, not to mention wage slavery and so on, the things we were getting into earlier. They cover 150 years in 100 minutes of film, I guess as a documentary it looks like, from the ratification of the 13th Amendment in 1865 to the recent lethal encounters between black men and police. By the way, we had this discussion in a socialist alternative meeting in Worcester, Mass. Recently, and a young black woman said, don't forget about the repression of black women, and that was a very good thing to raise. I would add that here, because, you know, it just sticks out in my mind. Sandra Bond, remember her? The woman that was pulled over for a traffic stop, abused horribly,
in Texas.
Thrown into a cell for 2 days and died in the cell. And also just a lot of, I have in my mind a lot of images of black women, including an 84-year-old black woman recently was pepper sprayed in an encounter with the police somewhere. And of course, if you dig deeper into this, it's like with poverty, with anything else, you could say, well, aggregate numbers, it's people of white people and people of color, not necessarily just black people, all sorts of people of color that are abused, killed, you know, harassed by the police. Now, in aggregate numbers, that's true, but proportionally, black people are in a much greater proportion in relationship to whites and so on, targeted by police and all sorts of things from stop and frisk to the murders that have happened. And that's what this film starts to get into or gets into. And it's funny, they interview conservatives, they interview others, but a lot of without Michelle Alexander, which looks really good. And let's see what else it says here. I don't want to read the whole thing. It's a pretty good article again.
So when you see a Terry chain Ricky gang, that's literally slavery.
It depends. Some get paid, some don't. The conditions are certainly slave-ish. And let's see. There was a 2012 documentary by DuVernay called Middle of Nowhere, How Incarceration Affects the Spouses and Communities of the Imprisoned. And it's both more measured and more furious in 13th. I didn't see that one either, but I really want to see this one, the 13th. I don't know if it's going to get in the theaters or not.
Probably come out to the library.
And then there's a film called The Birth of a Nation about Nat Turner that is out in the theaters, I believe. And that's got some, you know, the way
that... Wasn't Birth of a Nation a racist?
Birth of a Nation was D.W. Griffith's racist film that did a lot to re-energize the Ku Klux Klan and therefore strengthen Jim Crow repression and lynchings and all the murders and everything.
Why would they name this film?
Well, because I don't know. I haven't seen it. I think it's because it's kind of mostly a nationalist perspective. I'm not talking about it too much because I haven't seen it. What I've read about it, I'm not that as thrilled about that as the 13th. Like to one review I read says the person that directed it has. You know, this scene where, like, made-up characters, there's a black person I was reading was reviewing it. There's made-up characters in it to make points about that simplify the struggle. Like, there's apparently this little kid in the film that snitches on Nate Turner. So that's like, don't be a snitch, but that's got nothing to do with, that was a made-up character.
So it's Hollywood at its best.
Yeah. And then at the end, there's an American flag thing and all this stuff. So it seems like a liberal... black nationalist
film
maybe. I haven't seen it, so I don't want to get into it like that, but that just doesn't really understand the whole situation. And this guy's been accused of rape, and one of the people he was accused of raping committed suicide. I believe it was a black woman, and it's the whole, I don't know. I'm not as excited about that, The Birth of a Nation. And I don't understand that. Yeah, I don't understand using that title either.
Why use that title? It's about Nat Turner.
Birth of a Black Nation, if you're a black nationalist, you know, I guess. I don't know. That's my guess.
They should get away from it. Even the nation should even be on the title. It should be about Nat Turner.
I don't know.
The Revolt or something, you know?
Yeah. No, I can't speak to it. I haven't seen it, but I'm not as excited about it from what I've read as I am about the 13th. Hey, there's also, talking about media and stuff, a new issue of the monthly Socialist Alternative newspaper. And if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that we always talk about that. The October issue is out, issue number 27. Now, that sounds like not too many issues, but that's when we changed the name to Socialist Alternative from Justice. This issue is looking good. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I will point out this and read a bit from Why I Am a Socialist. This is a feature of every issue of Socialist Alternative, where we try to show newspaper, where we try to show, look, you too can be a socialist, and here's average working people that become socialists, and here's why. And they're very articulate, and I really like it. And so basically, Desta Waldo, security guard at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. There's a picture of Desta with an airport worker's T-shirt on. It's brilliant. So Desta says, quote, coming to the U.S. 13 years ago as an immigrant student from Ethiopia, I was excited to start a better life. But after I got here, I realized there are all kinds of social problems here, too. People work too hard for too little and can't get by, living unhealthy and unhappy lives. This also makes it hard for people to get involved in politics and social activism. I realize that if people work full-time and have a hard time getting by, there is a problem. People's wages do not keep up with inflation, so people's incomes are becoming more and more inadequate. I work at Northeastern University as a dorm security guard. After my first 5 years with no benefits and no raises, oh my God, we realized we had to do something. I helped to organize the other security guards into our union, SEIU Local 615-32BJ. So that's great news. When we got the union, it was really exciting. We were all happy to finally talk about our problems with somebody other than our fellow workers. We all thought we were going to get raises and wages and benefits right away after we signed the union card, but it took us 4 years because of the stale, slow pace of the negotiations. Now, I'm going to end right there for a second and explain that. This is really important for our listeners to understand, because I realize most of you aren't in unions, probably. Like, right now, the union density is so low that there's just so many people out there that aren't in unions. And so if you see a union struggle, hopefully you'll support it. If you want to organize a union in your workplace, there's ways to do it, but it's difficult. And one of the difficulties is, once you get the union in through either a recognition of your strength, this is rare, but it does happen, where so many people are pro-union, they've signed cards or petitions to show it, that the bosses say, okay, we recognize the union. That's very rare, but it does happen, especially if people go on strike for recognition and stuff like that. Usually what happens, though, is that you get enough cards, a majority. Usually you need like 70% to be sure you're going to win the election. You petition, and this is fraught with problems, but I'm going to explain how this normally goes. You go to the National Labor Relations Board. They set up an election. There's always a time frame between the time you petition for election and the time there is one. It's usually a long time, and that's when the bosses then hire anti-union companies to come in and brainwash and scare workers to vote against the union. Now, if you survive that and you get the union in, which they did here at Northeastern among the security guards, survive that, then you have to negotiate a first contract. And there's no law in the country that says you have to negotiate a first contract with the workers if you're a boss, if you're a corporation. It just says you have to negotiate in good faith. And at a certain point, if you reach an impasse, you reach an impasse. You know, and it's ill-defined what an impasse is. So they just keep negotiations going on until the union gives up, or there are impasses declared that stands up in the NLRB, and you never get there's a certain percentage. Then I used to know this fact, and it's escaped me now, but it's kind of, I have to look at the most recent statistics. But there was a huge percentage of, like, I'm like over a majority of places that organized into a union but never got a first contract. I'm personally familiar, like, for example, in this area, a lot of United Food and Commercial Workers. They go out and do a lot of organizing compared to other unions, but I rarely see them get that first contract. And I hope I'm wrong about that. I hope they do it a lot more than I realize. And that's a big problem you have to understand. So when you're organizing, if you're starting to organize a union, you got to think ahead to when you're going to organize first contract. And the best thing to do is to get strong enough. This is how it should go down. You shouldn't be on your own. It should be the labor movement as a whole is supporting your effort to organize. And through the labor movement as a whole, through maybe a general strike or a big strike in an area, or just a strike backed up really strongly, you're able to get that recognition and contract right away. And that's doable. You can actually do that. It's hard, but it's better than just waiting along to be, you know, killed over time slowly, you know. Back to Desda's statement here, why I'm a socialist. Quote, thanks to the union, we're now all making over $15 an hour. But SEIU could do a lot more if they weren't so closely tied to the Democratic Party, a party that I have learned is bought out by corporate cash through and through. SEIU endorsed Hillary Clinton instead of Bernie Sanders in the primary without consulting the workers. But workers and unions shouldn't settle for the lesser of two evils. Socialist Alternative is fighting for a new party, a party of working people and their unions, of all races and religions and nationalities, a party of the 99% that challenge the corporate two-party system and capitalism itself. I'm a socialist because I care about the future, not only for my own sake, but for the sake of generations to come. People all over the world should be able to live in peace, not war. Our first priority should be to fight against hunger and disease and for the well-being of our children and the environment. I believe the United States has the potential to do great things, but we have to use our resources the right way, and this is not possible when we have an economic system where profit is the primary motive. I believe that ordinary working people of the world can run society democratically to make it work for all of us, and that's socialism. That's a really, really brilliant, yeah. So Desda, that's a statement by Desda Waldo, a security guard at Northeastern University, about why I am a socialist. That's excellent. I think she was involved in, or is involved in, helping the union organize at the airport. Airport workers back in the day used to be well paid, heavily unionized. That all changed in the 90s and early 2000s, maybe even going back to the 80s. They busted union after union.
Oh, after 9/11, it was like, oh, this is an excuse to...
Even before that,
remember,
too.
Okay. If you travel in the United States in an American airline or any American, you know, carrier, right? No food, but they'll sell you food. It used to be included in the... Unless you're going internationally.
Yep.
Right? You get on these other planes like airport or whatever, they give you food.
Yep. Yep. But what I'm talking about is like...
So they use that as an excuse. Yeah. Oh, no, we lost a lot of money because of 9/11.
Well, they haven't lost any money. Yeah,
that's what they drilled on us after 9/11.
Yeah, you're right. Right,
and they use an excuse. Yeah. Well, I can't give you or serve food now, but I'll still sell you food. You know what I mean?
Right. Yep, totally. I think you're right. But recently, over the last few years, the airlines are making more profits than ever before. They're back to consolidate. They're back to being very, very consolidated into monopolies. There's only a few airlines in the United States now, and despite the branding, they're really owned by fewer people, and it's just basically a really, really rotten situation where they were able to bust a lot of unions representing people like baggage handlers, food service workers, like you were mentioning, and others. Now, in some places, those workers are getting reorganized into unions. In other places, it's just sort of the beginning stages of that. And so different airports around the country, there are like airport worker campaigns, usually led by SEIU, to try to prepare the ground for, unionization and getting some things they can get through protesting, like, because the wages are just dirt poor, cheap, horrible wages in a lot of cases for very hard work, you know, like baggage handling and stuff. By the way, in this new issue of Socialist Alternatives newspaper, there was one other article. I mean, there's a lot of good articles I'd like to get into, but don't have a lot of time for. Starting to run out of time a little bit. For example, back page, we need a party, 99%, vote Jill Stein. We'll get into that in a minute. But here's a little article on the same page as Desta's statement. Seattle wins secure scheduling. Now, out in Seattle recently, with Shama Sawan, you know, the only socialist city council member, but having one at all is brilliant, and she's been reelected recently. In the last month or so, there's been these really good victories in Seattle that haven't got much press, obviously, beyond Seattle, and that is that in Seattle, the Democratic mayor and all but two of the Democratic Party city councilors, and they're all Democrats, except for Shama. They wanted to give the police, I think it was $160 million or more in money to build a big police headquarters, a brand new shiny headquarters to bring people in and terrorize them and stuff. And
like the Bosk, right?
Well, we called it the bunker. And so did other groups.
How
so.
Would the French say the boss? How you say
the
that?
The boss?
No, the
patron. What?
No, the place that they used to take people and torture them. The
oh, that's prison, the Bastille.
The Bastille. I love how they just took it apart.
Yeah,
you know the people.
Totally gone. Yeah, no. I used to go there and see that and stay in that neighborhood. It used to be relatively cheap. I don't think it is anymore. And yeah, you can see that all that's left is like the bricks on the ground outlining where it was.
can you tell there was some class anger there?
Yeah, they tore that down. So we called it, and there was Black Lives Matter in Seattle was involved in this and other groups, the bunker. So this movement that we helped lead defeated the bunker. It was called the Bunker Busters. So, and that's a big victory because really the establishment, the Democrats were really all for it. And they even did a tour of the old police station, and everyone was expecting to see like decrepit, rotten conditions. They weren't that bad at all. And so it backfired. And in any case, the mayor backed off. So their new budget was set without $160 million going to the cop shop, the big bunker. And what we called for was a social alternative, called for 1,000 houses in Shama, 1,000 houses to be built, where using that money, low-income houses to be built instead of the bunker. And they didn't fall through on that, but at least it's out there in a big way. And there's all these other things that happened recently, about four or five different things that we kind of won on through either, you know, leadership of social alternative or being heavily involved. And one of them is this secure scheduling thing. Listen to this. Seattle wins secure scheduling. Now, what happens when you work in retail? They've got it down to, in a lot of places, they give you your schedule for the next week, you know, at the end of the week, previous week, you know, oh, it's Friday. Here's your schedule for next week. Come in tomorrow morning. Open tomorrow morning. You know, next week you have Thursday off, well, when you usually always had Tuesday off or whatever.
Or even worse, for places like Clover where everything's internet. You assume everybody's, you know,
yeah,
you know,
walking around
like
with
a little droid.
Their $100 phone, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like they can, I've had situations where I'm supposed to be in at 6 in the morning or 6:30. I come in and the boss will come and say, hey, because I can't punch in because
yeah.
He changed my schedule in the middle of the night. To oh put me God. In at 12 to
oh
something.
Oh, my God. That's so evil.
But it is locked in the system because it's so into the, you know, the Google yeah. and everything to yeah. punch in. I'm yeah. putting in my email address,
yep.
and it doesn't allow me to punch in. It literally blocks me off because you're not scheduled. You do not have a schedule. And I'm like, no, yep. I did.
Yeah.
But he switched it on me, forgot to text me. So it's like,
yeah.
really?
Yeah. And that's a really horrible
example. And I
live
around the corner. If, yeah. if I'm coming from East Boston,
you're dead.
Like, no, I'm coming in, I'm working, I'm leaving at the time I'm
yep.
supposed to.
Yep. So that's a great example. And in Britain, they call it just-in-time scheduling or something like that, or no, or zero-hour scheduling or something. And no, I'm sorry, not they don't call it just-in-time scheduling, they call it zero-hour scheduling or something. And this is ubiquitous, this is all throughout retail now. And it's horrible. So there's been people fighting back here and there saying, no, you have to schedule workers ahead of time, like you should, of course. Or put them on a regular schedule. Anyway, so on September 19th, 2016, the Seattle labor movement wrested a landmark victory for big business, becoming just the second city after San Francisco to pass a secure scheduling ordinance. The bill applies to businesses that operate in Seattle and have more than 500 employees worldwide. It's a major... Now, that's a little problem there, right, if you think about it carefully, but at least something got passed. The bill applies to business to operate in Seattle.
Well, it's worldwide.
500 employees. Oh, worldwide. Okay, that's
so
good.
So now it's like if it's covers a Walmart, more. They yeah. can't go, well, we only have 400
right.
you know, worldwide.
Right. Exactly.
That's impossible.
Right. It is a major step forward for ordinary working people. Labor should continue the fight to extend secure scheduling rights to all workers. To enforce secure scheduling, the bill mandates 14 days advance notice for regular shifts, a good faith estimate of available hours, including on-call expectations at the time of hiring, additional predictability pay for shifts that are altered within the 14-day window, recognition of a worker's right to at least 10 hours of rest between shifts, and the posted offering of additional hours and shifts to current employees for 3 full days before new workers are hired. Additionally, bosses aren't allowed to force employees to find replacement coverage when using protected leave. It was the continued activity of the labor movement in Seattle that put the pressure on establishment politicians. Electing Socialist Alternative Council member Shama Sawant has raised the sights of working people and created an atmosphere that has Seattle big business on their back foot. Specifically, Working Washington, United Food and Commercial Workers, and other local unions and labor affiliates should be commended for this victory. Seattle is proving that there is another way, that when we have the will to fight, we can win. And workers are taking notice. Every victory that we win, builds the confidence of workers in other cities to fight for their rights, too. So in our modest way, we're getting out the word here. Seattle and San Francisco, yeah. Check out Secure Scheduling. This was an article written by
Those
Ben.
Those platforms of ideas right there. That's
yeah, exactly. Victories. And this was written, this article, by Ben Peterson of Socialist Alternative in this new issue, October 2016, Socialist Alternative. So, yeah, and we're going to set that aside for now. Real quickly, some international stuff we want to highlight. In Poland, over 140,000 women demonstrate against total ban on abortion. Now, that made the media a little bit, so maybe you've heard about this. A couple things I can add sort of, again, below the radar as a socialist. Socialist Alternative in the United States is in political solidarity with the Committee for Workers International, which is a group of socialist groups and parties around the world in about 50 countries and in every continent, probably with the exception of Antarctica. But anyway, in Poland, there's a right-wing government. They tried to pass a law. There's hardly any abortion rights left in Poland. It has one of the most restrictive anti-abortion laws in Europe, allowing abortion only in the case of rape, a threat to the health or life of the woman, or a deformation of the fetus. In practice, even when these conditions are fulfilled, abortion is often prevented by doctors who exploit the so-called conscience clause, unquote, and impose their own religious beliefs on patients by refusing vital treatment. This is from an article by Paul Newbery from Alternative Socialista. I can't pronounce it, although I used to speak Polish when I was a kid. Alternatywa Socjalistyczna, CWI in Poland. October 5th. So go to socialistworld.net for more of this article. The title is Poland, over 140,000 women demonstrate against total ban on abortion. Now, one reason we're reading this,
anybody is because doing an abortion can be arrested too. Any doctors.
That's in the U.S., France. I think. That's not here in Poland. Is in Poland too? Okay.
No, in Poland, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
I heard it with the French newscast that said they were arresting any doctor that was found. Yeah. Violating that, yeah. Like doing an abortion would be arrested, you know.
Right.
I think it was like a 5-year.
Right.
And lose their license and everything.
So this little window of abortion rights was closed even further, or proposed to be closed by a total ban on abortion, but it sparked a massive explosion of anger in Poland. A strike of women, it was called. It was a big protest inspired by the example of Icelandic women who held a nationwide strike in 1975 in Warsaw, where 50,000 demonstrated. It turns out, you know, I saw some of the pictures. There were some men on the demos, but mostly women. 50,000 demonstrated in the pouring rain in Wroclaw, 30,000, Krakow, 25,000, etc. The pictures were amazing. These were huge demonstrations. The police, you could see the police kind of swallowing hard and standing back, because when you get that many people on the street, they're not anxious to mix it up, which is good. And they won, but here's the problem. They won, but very quickly people said, wait a minute, we haven't really won. All we did was we kept the status quo, which was not good. Status quo is what I just read. Not very many rights for abortion. So I think this struggle will probably continue and try to get real abortion rights, real choice in Poland. And I was glad to see this, because there's this picture painted of Poland as being extremely conservative. Now, I come from Polish ethnicity and on my mother's side, and used to speak it when I was a kid and so on. And I'm a revolutionary socialist, and I met Polish people that are revolutionary socialists, and it's not true that we're all enslaved to the Catholic Church and etc. But of course Stalinism did a number on Poland, and so there is a lot of superficial, at least anti-socialist rhetoric there. You got a right-wing government, but they did have more progressive governments, relatively speaking, in power since the fall of Stalinism. And it's a complicated situation. I mean, Socialist Alternative, that's the Polish name, the name of the CWI group in Poland, they do operate, and they do openly, and they do organize and stuff. And they're the Polish labor movement, there's still big unions, mine workers, nurses, and so on, that go on strike. So there is a left there. And there's other sorts of radicals running around. But it seems like the way that it's portrayed in the media here, oh, that's a conservative country, and just, you know, get used to it. But things are changing in Europe. Another example of that is, everyone's here, when we talked about on the show, the Brexit vote, which actually, if you really got down to it, it turns out it was a vote against the EU, not a vote of some sort of racist conspiracy. And that... it actually, working people voted to leave the EU. The stats have come out and shown that it was mostly working people that wanted to leave and rich people that wanted to stay. What has the European Central Bank ever done for a worker in Britain except, make it so they lose their jobs and can't get credit and so on. So what happened here was the most recent thing, moving beyond Brexit, was the Labour Party had an internal vote for leadership. and Jeremy Corbyn, a real socialist, as opposed to Bernie Sanders, a fake socialist. Jeremy Corbyn, a real socialist, although with problems. He's more of a reformist than revolutionary socialist, but still he's a socialist with a long history on the left in Britain. He was surprisingly elected in a special election about a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago. And that surprised the heck out of everybody there. And it threw the right wing of the Labour Party, which was moving to the right up until Corbyn got elected, threw the right wing into, frenzy. And they've been trying ever since to get rid of Corbyn, and they still are. And they put a lot of their weight behind an election that just happened in Britain within the Labour Party. And they used the courts to disqualify a bunch of people from voting in the Labour Party. And guess what? Corbyn won. Corbyn, left candidate Jeremy Corbyn, re-wins Labour leadership with bigger majority than he got the first time around.
It's like a Shamwat here, you know? He keeps on winning. Yeah. He keeps on winning. What's going on?
Yeah, that happened with Sharma. Sharma got a bigger share of the vote when she ran for re-election this past year than in her original election. Same with Corbyn. Now, Corbyn, the British Labour Party, by the way, is not like... It is an old Social Democratic Party, meaning it started out revolutionary, very quickly became not very quickly, but over time. Yeah,
they hated Churchill.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, and they have times where they are more radical than other times, but they're basically a reformist party. But they're a party that's so big with such deep traditions in the working class that if they get energized and pulled to the left, there's going to be more socialists running around, more campaigns. That are probably of good demands around issues and so on. And if there's going to be a revolutionary party, a bigger revolutionary party in Britain, which hopefully there will be, elements will come from the Labour Party. There's no doubt about it. And the organization affiliated to the CWI, the Socialist Party of Britain, certainly shows that in its development. And initially, it worked within the Labour Party back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and grew to a large size as far as the left goes, and et cetera. I don't have time for the whole history there, but check out the Socialist Party of England and Wales at socialistworld.net. You can get a link to their website. This is an article from their website by who wrote it? There's no byline I can see. I guess it was written collectively there. Who wrote it? Okay. Not getting an individual author, but anyway, this is from the Socialist Party of CWI England and Wales website from September 24th, reporting on Corbyn winning. Just a few points here. 3 months ago, 172 members of Parliament, three-quarters of the Parliamentary Labour Party, these are the people serving as Labour Party representatives from the old right-wing days, they launched a coup against Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. They have been backed by all the forces of the capitalist establishment, big business, the right-wing media. They've endlessly attacked Jeremy, while the Labour machine has prevented many thousands of his supporters from voting in the vote, in the contest. All their efforts have come to nothing. I like that sentence. All their efforts are coming to nothing. Jeremy has been reelected on 24 September with a huge margin, with 61.8% of the vote, even wider than in his initial victory. And so now it's questionable what program Corbyn will fight on. He keeps trying to do this stuff lately where he wants to make peace with the very people that are trying to get rid of him. The Socialist Party, the group that Social Alternative would be in political solidarity with, they caution against that way, rely on the membership, which is a lot of new members, a lot of radicalized members, a lot of youth, and the right wing Labour Party hates us over there, hates the Socialist Party because they're afraid of a repeat of the late 80s where the Labour Party shifted to the left based on an infusion of socialists and support for socialist ideas from the Committee for Workers International grouping there called the Militant at the time. Let's see. Yeah, I don't know. That's all I'll do on that for now. There's a lot more to talk about, but we're running out of time, and I've got this irritating noise in the background I'm going to try to get rid of by playing a song real quickly, and then we'll be back right after this song. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on WMFO 91.5 FM, Tusk Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. Enjoy the song. We'll be right back.
When I was young, I dreamed a dream to battle the things that I was gonna be.
That was New Model Army with Great Expectations, a song from their album New Model Army Original 20. New Model Army is an old punk group from back in the day, but they've existed, stayed together, putting out music to this day, as far as I know, at least as of a couple of years ago. I just always liked their music. I saw them in Cambridge a long time ago, back in the early 90s, I think it was.
In the Middle East?
Yeah. No. Remember T.T. and the Bears?
Oh, next to it?
Yeah, that's gone now.
Are they socialists or are they Rage Against the Machine?
They're I don't know what they call themselves, but they seem socialist to me. Okay. That's a good question. And especially since they're older now, not that I don't want to sound ageist, I'm old, I mean, but I'd like to think about that for a second. You know, the cliche is the older you get, the more conservative you get. And I have to say, among people that I know, that's kind of true. Like, I have friends that, for example, they're going to vote for Clinton, that they wouldn't have thought of doing that, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. They were just sickened by the two-party system and all the duopoly, the pro-capitalist nature of the duopoly and all that. And now they're just, boring old lesser evilists. But then again, I do know people that are older that get radicalized in old age. I've met people that said, all my life I was, voted for Democrats and now I see through it. So I don't know. I don't have the statistics. I don't have the data. I'm just giving anecdotal evidence, cuts both ways. I know I'm getting, I've been radical since, junior high or something like that, I don't know. I don't think I'm getting more conservative. I think I'm keeping kind of a level of left wing class anger.
Well, when you see reality, you just pretty gotta there, look at it how it is, and it,
By the way, we're gonna talk about the elections now, finally, in our last 5-10 minutes, and we won't do it justice, obviously. Before we do that, though, I want to recommend the book, "The Democrats: A Critical History" by Lance Selfa, 2012 edition, if you can get it. Also, I haven't read this yet, but someone in Social Alternative recommended to me Nancy Eisenberg, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And I'm dying to read it to figure out why she puts that label on it when we make a big point in Social Alternative of class. Unlike the way it's described in academia, class is really everyone that has to sell or try to sell their labor to live, and that's mostly people of color on a worldwide basis. So, I don't know why she would. Maybe because she's looking at the U.S. and I don't know. We'll have to think about it. But also, I just noticed that Counterpunch, Jeffrey St. Clair, came out with a book about Sanders. Very thin, like 87-page notes from the field, I think he calls it, where he talks about Sanders, which looks really interesting. But anyway, let's talk about this sort of bait and switch election. Now, why would I call it bait and switch? Because it seems to me like every time people start to understand Clinton a little more, Trump will do something Trumpish, something obviously.
Well, my mother calls me up and says, like, "How'd you like the novelas last time?" I'm like, "What are you talking about? The debate? That's the novelas. Novelas is soap opera.
Soap operas, yeah.
So I'm like, oh god.
I watched the last debate for the most part. I couldn't watch the whole thing; it was a little too much. But
the one I liked was the one with Amy Goodman on the same question of the vice president of both. Of the both parties. Now they had the independent response to it of the Green.
Yep.
I forgot his
Jill
name.
Jill Stein. No, it's a woman.
No, the guy. It's vice president.
Baraka, yeah.
Baraka, yeah. Yes.
And I'm spacing on his first name too, which is really bad because I have.
I think it was James Barak, no?
No. That's no. And I could find that information in a second, but we're running out of time, so I'm not going to be able to actually. But he's quite a good speaker. And, I hope actually he can come and speak in Worcester soon. We'll see about that. And Jill Stein is the Green Party candidate, in case you haven't heard, because corporate media is pretty much keeping her out of the loop and keeping her out of the debate.
Well, they asked her about the war, and she said, "I will have an embargo on all sides."
Right.
That makes sense.
Yep. Well, that's a good point, that in all the lesser evil back and forth between liberals that are willing to vote for Clinton no matter what, it appears, no matter what you say about Clinton's past policies or present stances, they're just like, "I'm afraid of Trump. She's better than Trump, blah, blah, blah." Yeah, okay. Is she much better than Trump? Is she different than Trump? Yeah. Is she, what does she represent? Is it about her as an individual? I mean, it's the whole arguments are so superficial. They're almost childish. And yet grown people are running around, even as I speak, thinking, number one, thinking that their personal vote is the be all and end all of everything, you know, and it's not. They're personally, you have to put your vote into a matrix of, you know, hundreds of millions of votes. I'm not saying it makes it meaningless. I'm just saying that, you know, using it to be sort of on the winning side or something, what does that matter? I mean, we should be building for the future. If you're a serious socialist, a serious revolutionary socialist, every election is to build for the future. It's not that to just for that election. Even if you're fighting, even if you have a chance of winning, like Shama Sawan and Social Alternative in Seattle, that wasn't about winning one position on a city council seat. That's about building a movement in Seattle and beyond that will result in many, many socialists winning seats, many, many progressive leftists winning seats, but more importantly, being able to use all that energy and power to pass legislation, however temporary it will be under capitalism, that can improve working people's lives, put the pressure on the other parties to not to force them to go along with it or to defeat them in the struggle, and then to build for what really has to happen, a fundamental transition to socialism. You know, there's no way around that. Ultimately, capitalism has to be done away with, or every reform you make will be taken away. And we've seen that. We've already in this show talked about things that used to exist for workers that don't exist anymore. And we're talking about not 100 years ago, but 20 years ago.
I mean, look at what we're in process right now, the chop block on the, if you're in retail.
Yep. They want to get rid of the Massachusetts of law of time and a half on Sundays.
Time and a half.
Now, the other thing is I think about a lot is that when Trump came out with these, you know, sexist, abusive comments that are really disgusting because, you know, I hate people like Trump. I hate the ruling class. I hate the capitalists. They, you know, there can be nice individual capitalists, but if they stay capitalist, what they're doing isn't nice, and they probably aren't going to remain that way for long. If they're really trying to do something good, they're just not going to be able to. They're going to be forced out. There's a complete contradiction between short-term maximization of profit and doing good in society. It's just like completely different. So, on the one hand, I'm not surprised by Trump. That's the way they think. If you ever met really rich people, they do exude the power and arrogance of their class role of what they're doing, you know, and it's disgusting, and you can smell it, you know, and you just want to be away from it. It's just disgusting. They're abusing people with their power. They can make people run and jump in the workplace, outside the workplace, based on their power in society. And what
they're like the new kings, you know?
Exactly. So Trump says these things that when Trump, they're just horrible about women. And now in my head, that just reaffirmed what I know about people like Trump, what I know about the ruling class, and how necessary it is to bring about fundamental change for democratic socialism. So people like that can't act on their power trips because they don't control power. They don't control the means of production. They don't control real estate and buildings and stuff like Trump does and all that. Never once did it enter my mind that, oh, because Trump is a pig and an idiot, I need to vote for Hillary Clinton. That never once entered my mind because I know that Hillary Clinton, in her own way, is doing the bidding of people like Trump and is much like Trump herself. Not in terms of the weird, ugly, sexist, abusive women comments and so on, but because if Trump loses the election, does he lose social status in any real sense in terms of his money and so on? Does he become less of a capitalist pig?
No.
Under the Clinton administration? Absolutely
not. He'll just go to his little...
He did quite well under Clinton. He's personal friends with Clinton.
Yeah.
You know, his banter about being on the golf course and having Bill Clinton say worse things about women than he did is, of course, I would bet that's true. But that's not the point. The point, if any feminist, even a bourgeois feminist, even a feminist that only cares about rich women, essentially, and the glass ceiling and all that, even they must know that people like Trump and Clinton are inherently sexist. That's part of the capitalist system. You know, that is there for a reason. The history of capitalism is imbued racism, with sexism. Yeah, you know. But I guess some people are surprised by that.
Did you know who he had in the church in the black? He tried to appeal to the black voters.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
Don
Muhammad.
Right? No. What's his
King,
name?
Don King. Yeah. No, I know. Yeah,
this is the guy.
And Trump has also said things in terms of racism that is just as bad as these sexist comments. If you have to use some sort of scale of evil, you know, and yet this is the one that gets him in trouble. You know, and I'm glad. I like to see him get in trouble. Like we said earlier in the show, I hope the guy is forced to resign. That would be brilliant. That would be great. I hate Trump. We hate Trump, and it would throw a big wrench in the system.
Where's the power vacuum for that? Now the independents should come in and say, okay.
Well, now that won't happen. It will go to Clinton. But the point is that Clinton that they can't keep up the illusion of difference between the two parties. They're not the same, but their differences are not that fundamental. On basic questions of economics and basic questions of imperialism, of foreign policy, so-called, they are the same. Then there's all this difference about social questions. That's true, and there's difference on some questions, at least in terms of promises made, about how to address economic questions, but not fundamentally, you know? And as you probably know, even as that story broke about Trump and his rotten, horrible statements, the WikiLeaks came out with stuff about Clinton's speeches to Goldman Sachs and so on that show she's even more out of touch with middle-class people than supposedly people. I mean, of course, we know that in Social Alternative and Revolutionary Socialists know that. But, you know, there's stuff about class and about demands and stuff that show she's clearly more right-wing than she's letting on. That she's, you know, her rhetoric against the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement is really, she was for it before, that she came out against it due to pressure from Sanders. And now she's against it still, supposedly, but then this thing gets leaked where she wants that for North America. She wants even more NAFTA on steroids, so to speak.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. She says something like a hemispheric world market something.
So if you're like we are, angry at Trump and don't want to see the right wing gain, it's not, you don't vote for Clinton. Clinton is going to make that worse. Clinton is herself right from a certain perspective. And is consciously, and you can read stuff she said about this, constantly positioning herself politically in a slide to the right of U.S. politics on that level, not in terms of real politics on the ground, but in that level of the capitalist class, that she's going to continue to rule that way. She's campaigning on the status quo, but the status quo is untenable for most Americans. And most people around the world, I would argue, in terms of American foreign policy and in U.S. imperialism. Therefore, liberals are wondering why, especially upper middle class liberals who are comfortable with the status quo, they're wondering, why would anyone even consider voting for Trump? Why would anyone not consider voting for Clinton? Clinton herself said, why aren't I higher in the polls, you know? Because you're putting forward policies that are killing us, killing the climate, killing us, killing, you know, people overseas. And you ask to accept that as the best, as the lesser evil, when it's just another evil, slightly different evil, not a lesser evil.
Yeah. Thanks to her, Libya's five different territories now.
Yeah.
It's not Libya, it's five different territories. Yep.
And you look
they don't have a country, they have territories.
And you look at Trump, and Trump is, you know, the epitome of a powerful, rich capitalist and the way they treat people and the way they treat women, and it's horrible, right? On the other hand, Trump, in terms of his power in this election and in this society, it doesn't compare in many ways to Clinton's power. Clinton has generals lining up behind her, ex-presidents lining up behind her, big corporations throwing billions and dollars into her, or millions of dollars, I won't say billions,
potential for nuclear
tens of millions
war
into her campaign. She's already sat in the centers of power with as Secretary of State and as a senator. Trump is unelected. Now, is that some sort of apology for Trump? Not at all. Trump is completely, you know, worthless as a politician of any sort. Not that I'm not making the experience argument. I'm just making the argument that Trump, based on what he stands for and what he says, are worthless to working people. Those are worthless. Even when he gives a crumb, like he started to talk about child care. subsidies. If you read the fine print, it's nothing. It's nothing.
And he's debated just like this. He's like, I created I. It's all about him. Yeah.
It should be the other way around. Every penny Trump has came from the labor of working people. Even money that he got through speculation came from things speculated upon that were built by working people. Anyway, I'm going to quote here from a socialist alternative, a couple quotes from Socialist Alternative, a pamphlet we just put out about lesser evilism. Quote, most people recognize that our political system is broken. The two countless parties have produced a presidential election between the two most unpopular candidates in living memory. Millions watch in disbelief as a billionaire bigot appears to be within striking distance of the White House. Meanwhile, there's huge anger and distrust for Clinton's corporate campaign. Democratic Party establishment sidelining of Bernie Sanders, still the most popular politician in America, shows that they are more committed to Wall Street and big business than to defeating Trump and the Republicans. Now we can build a movement to cut across the rise of right-wing populist. How can we build a movement to cut across the rise of right-wing populists? Is it possible to build a new mass party of the 99%, completely independent of corporate corruption? This pamphlet makes the case for building a left political alternative to the Democratic Party and answers the arguments of those backing Clinton as the lesser evil to Trump. And a companion quote here by Shama Sawant, Seattle Socialist City Council member of Social Alternative, quote, I want Trump to lose this election. But progressives should not support Clinton. Her close ties to corporate America and its brutal neoliberal agenda will serve to increase the appeal of right-wing populism, even if she wins. That's why I'm supporting Jill Stein. So we urge listeners to check out Jill Stein on Facebook or the internet, wherever you can get information about the Stein campaign. She's standing for a $15 minimum wage. She's standing for eliminating student debt.
She's standing for a peaceful solution.
Yep. She's standing against U.S. imperialism in many cases.
By embargo on all sides.
Free higher education, taxing the rich, rapid transition to renewable energy. Really good demands. And if you're hung up on the fact, but she won't win, that's not the point. Her campaign, if it gets enough support, will help build a future independent workers' party, a party for the 99% that will be independent of the money of big business. And I don't think it'll be the Green Party. It will be left Greens joining others to build a party that will be able to take on and win, especially in local elections initially, and then later other elections, larger elections, statewide, national. We're running out of time. We're out of time, basically. I was going to give some other article references, but we'll do that next time. Thanks for listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. We really appreciate your support. Vote Stein. Vote no on question two if you're here in Massachusetts. And, there's other ballot questions we can talk about.